All right. So we just wrapped up a conversation with Todd Olson, CEO of Pendo. Baird and I were on with him, and we covered some really great stuff. We got into the three main jobs of a CEO. I'm not going to spoil it. You're going to hear all this in just a minute. Three main jobs of a CEO: how to think about fundraising, operating rhythms, OKRs, the advantage, Patrick Lencioni, rhythm. The rhythm method is what I was thinking when he said that. Pricing. We had a really interesting conversation on pricing.
That was my favorite part. Digging into the pricing and how they've done it. And also because they've been around for so long. Well, over 10 years, right? That he's been running this company and he's been through so many iterations of it. To hear him talk through how they've approached pricing was... And it's a lot of the heart. Pricing is so hard too. And he just had a really great approach. It was good.
He sort of cut right through all the complexity, just down to the core of the matter, which is really good.
Product-led growth versus sales explanation that he gave was spot on. It was good.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Todd is the founder and CEO of Pendo. He was wearing his $200 million Pendo shirt because they just crossed $200 million in ARR. So there are very few people that can go from founder all the way to CEO of a $200 million company that could literally go public at some point, probably in the next few years. Super honored to have him on the podcast. It was a great conversation. I just hit record, by the way, just so we don't miss any of the good stuff. But I told Baird, this is partially us selfishly picking your brain on how to scale ourselves to $100 million. So
yeah, not a problem. Like we all beg, borrow, and steal from the prior generations. You know, that's the way it works. If you like, I mean, and we want to share. I mean, that's the great part. You know, that's the crazy thing about it being entrepreneurs too. It's like you kind of have to be a little bit like strong-headed to start a company because so many people tell you no, and you know, just like it's never just an easy path. So kind of knowing what to listen to from other people and what not is, I think, one of the biggest skills. And that's everything from other entrepreneurs to board members to you name it. Because some things that we do will work at your company and some things we do probably won't. And it's your job to sift through the stuff that will and stuff that won't. And also ignore some of the voices that are irritating versus the ones that aren't. You know, I still have that challenge today. You know, there's some people that like some very loud voices that are just like, yeah. I'm going to ignore that, but yeah.
See, that's why I hit the record button right away because, you know, that was gold right there. What does your shirt say? Is that 200 million?
Yeah, we crossed 200 in ARR and decided to make a t-shirt out of it. Or a sweatshirt.
Yeah, you guys have strong t-shirt game, if I recall correctly.
It is part of our, it's like an unwritten cultural rule is that we have a lot of swag. And so I don't know how this happened, but I probably feed this beast to some degree. And, and the interesting thing is, well, I decided years ago that I wanted a uniform. You know, I, of course, read the Steve Jobs uniform. Not to compare myself to Steve Jobs. That would be just crazy. But I like this concept of not having to think about what I'm wearing every day because it's just brain cells that I don't want to expend in the morning when I'm like trying to get to work. So I wear a Pendo t-shirt or shirt. It's a little colder today, so sweatshirt and jeans. And that's it. And sneakers. Like that's my core uniform. But then it's gotten to a point where I look at my schedule and I see kind of what is happening today and do I wear a t-shirt from that team or from that product line or from like something historical? Like I have t-shirts going back to 2014. So sometimes I'll like pull out something that's 10 years old, probably to make a point in some talk I'm making to some group of people at Pendo. And like, I'll bring it back to this event that occurred sometime in the past. So because of this, every team gives me their shirts now going forward. So I just have a lot of them. I mean, I have four drawers in my closet, all dedicated to Pendo swag.
Now you're back to having to think about what you're wearing every day. It went full circle.
Well, sometimes now my EA will write like a suggestion on what I should be wearing in terms of shirt. So, but there's some classics. Like if I'm going to a different country or different whatever, but each office generally has their own swag. So I'll bring some office swag. But yeah, it's actually kind of nice. And now it's also made to the point where my wife refuses to go out and like a date with me if I'm wearing Pendo gear. So I make sure I then change when I get home to go out because wearing a logo, you know, a guy pushing 50, like all of his clothing has logos on it. It's pretty sad, right? So you know, I've had to now compliment my wardrobe so I look respectable at my age. So,
well, you know, don't grow up too much, Todd.
I'll try not to.
You'll be as fun.
Todd, I'm interested in this Turnkey's been around for about 3 years, and this is our first business that has a very long time horizon on it. Thanks to our retention rate, customers, it appears, stick around for a long period of time. So this is the first company where we're looking out 5-10 years plus. I'm interested, you know, I saw you all started in 2013. And the world was just completely different back then. Like, what was the early days of Pendo like, and how, I'm just interested to hear, like, did you all engineer for long lasting, or have you had to make a lot of twists and turns? What was, like, being in one business that long? I'm just curious to hear about that.
I mean, in some ways, yes. In some ways, no. There are certain core fundamentals that we engineered in, which are like core characteristics of a long-term business. You know, things like having documented core values and a focus on culture from day one. We still do it today. It looks a little different than it was, and obviously in 2013, 2014, but the core foundation is solid. Like, it's good. Like, it's kind of expected here now. Another big thing that I'm huge on is like what generally call like an operating rhythm or operating cadence. I worked in agile teams, so I like the 2-week sprints as an example. But I love cadence. Like, I love it. And every company has a different cadence. But we have a strong cadence. I mean, I have a whole PowerPoint deck on our cadence. You know, it's like every quarter we've been doing quarterly planning and goal setting since the company's history. Back at 6 people, we would sit in a conference room with 6 people and say, what are our goals for this quarter?
Nice.
What are our goals for this year? How do we measure ourselves against them? And we were good at saying, no, that's a sandbaggy goal. Like, we're not going to do that. We're going to push it, right? So we've been doing this since the very early days. It's looked a little different. We did OKRs. Then we went to this book called Rhythm that I liked. Then I moved to like the Table Groups Advantage. And then now we're back at OKRs, like, interestingly. So we actually went back. But the point was, it doesn't actually matter what framework you use. I actually don't care. Like, don't necessarily advocate for any one particular one. To have a framework and follow it. And that level of discipline is like super, super healthy. So as a good example, next week is our C-suite. So my direct offsite, we do them every quarter. And now once a year, we know as part of our like cadence is that we're going to talk about 3-5 year strategy, market landscape, all that jazz. We always do it at the beach. So I have a beach house. And so it's kind of like super no frills, kind of sitting in my living room at the beach. But it's something that we know it's going to get covered. Like, I don't need to sit around and say, oh, when are we going to talk about a 5-year plan? No, like, it's disciplined.
Every quarter.
Yes, every quarter. So then, and then of course, we do weekly exec team meetings. We do biweekly town halls. Like, one of the things I tell my team members is like an ad hoc meeting, we should have very few ad hoc meetings. Like, once at our size and scale, scheduling a meeting with executives is very difficult. It's almost prohibitively difficult.
Yeah.
So something gets moved. So like, I always know something from the cadence is going to accommodate it. So, I mean, go back to COVID. We couldn't have predicted that COVID was going to happen. But sure enough, there's a planning session like right around the corner. We got into it. We saw the world. We replanned our entire year. And like, it was just sort of a natural part of our cadence. They call COVID natural, but maybe we reacted to it, felt more natural than if we didn't have that.
What do you expect your executive team to do ahead of those meetings, like prep wise? I'm assuming you don't create a bunch of slides and all that crap. Like, do people prepare for that and bring documents and
pre-reviews? Sometimes yes, sometimes yes, sometimes no. It depends on the thing. And my chief of staff runs that meeting. And she will send out reads, which could be everything from articles I liked or did like to documents I wrote just to read, to like put in people's mind, to like, you know, homework to show up with. Like, throughout the years, it's changed. In every offsite, it's a little different depending on what we're hoping to accomplish in an offsite. So it depends. I mean, honestly, what I expect is for them to be present while they're there. Mm. Honestly, that's a big enough ask. Laptops down, don't want you on Slack. Let's like get off our phones. Like, let's be present. So we try to go pretty low tech. We, like I said, laptops are closed. We're using on Windows, big sheets of paper, sticky notes. We're trying to make sure we're just there in the moment and enjoying it.
That's really cool. We actually, the funny thing about what you just said is we literally went through our OKRs just a couple of hours ago.
That was great.
It's probably our first quarterly OKR session. So, you know, you've had this consistency for, you guys were founded in 2013, right?
Yes, correct.
So 11 years, you've been doing this consistent rhythm, different methodologies, that doesn't matter. But how have you changed as a CEO during this time? You had a lot of experience before you launched it there, right? But how have you changed since 2013?
Well, look, I mean, obviously the needs of me in the business change a lot throughout the years. And like the early days of, well, one, I think the CEO has three main jobs, you know, ultimately. And, you know, one is make sure the company never runs out of cash. And in the early days of the business, I spent a much greater percentage of my time making sure that happened than I do now. Now we announced that we're generating cash. We're over, you know, 200 ARR. Like, so I guess I'd spend less time on that than I've spent before. Not zero, but less. You know, the second thing that CEO needs to do is make sure you have a best in class team. So basically chief recruiting officer or what have you. So building team. That's constant. It was constant then. It's constant now. I spend a good chunk of my time just not only my team, but the team like a couple levels beneath. And that floats. And part of that is, yeah, you're going to lose someone. Like sometimes it's unexpected. Sometimes it's planned, but you're going to outgrow people. You're going to lose people. And sometimes you have to become, you know, the interim head of blah, blah, blah. So I've done many times at Pendo. I've run sales multiple times myself. I've run product myself. I've run the customer team myself. I've never had to run the finance team myself, but I've run nearly everything in the company. I've run personally for a period of time while we've had sort of a gap in leadership. So you have to do that. The third big thing, of course, is setting strategy for the business. And that's where in direction and focus, and that's where this planning cycle really helps. But look, I think throughout the years, like, yeah, you have to be comfortable understanding what you're willing to delegate and then what you hold close. Here's a great example. I used to actually interview every single human at Pendo until we got to 500 employees.
Wow.
Now, think about the 6 months prior to me stopping, how many interviews I had on a weekly basis at a company of our size and scale. I mean, it was crazy. It was at least half my time, maybe more. Now, did we hire well back then? Yeah. Did it create an extra bar? Whether I was, not saying I'm some like prescient interviewer. But trust me, if I'm going to interview every candidate, like people are going to be very careful about what candidates are putting in for me because it's a reflection of them.
Right.
Yeah. Both on the recruiter and the hiring manager, and set a tone. And I often used it as a hack. It wasn't just about interviewing. See, it was an opportunity for me to then go back to the hiring manager, have a coaching session. Is like, hey, why did you think this person was a good person for your team? What gaps do you see on your team? Did you think about this? Did you think about that? I read your reviews and I agreed on points A and B, but how did you ask questions around point C? This is before we had structured interviews and a bigger HR team.
Yeah.
It was kind of a hack because we didn't have a huge people team, but I wanted a way to kind of understand hotspots in the org and focus on it. Another big people thing is we had this pulse where we asked employees every week, 1 to 5, how they felt. That seems crazy, but I used to read like pretty much all of them every week, you know, when we're small, when certainly your size, I up through a couple hundred employees, I'd read them all. And I would see issues where there wasn't good communication or wasn't good transparency. There's something sort of broken in certain departments. So I developed my own mental heat map of the organization, all things I do not do now.
Yeah.
Now I have a professional HR team with HR business partners and they send me a heat map of all the things going on in the business and very, very, very different.
Yeah.
The same sort of concept exists, but there's a lot more of a machine underneath that's actually doing the work. So yeah, I think things were a little more hands-on back then. Today, there's again more of a mechanism. But there's some areas where I still like to be very involved, like product. As a lot of folks know, I'm a product. That's my background.
That's your trade.
Yeah. So I'm going to go deeper in those departments. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get a little more into the sausage making. I'm going to ask questions about backlogs. I mean, heck, I may even look at a Jira ticket or two. I mean, probably not a lot of those, yeah. but I certainly want to be involved in like design, the thought through. I want to help suggest ideas. When AI became super, super hot and everyone was asking, what's your AI strategy? We met, we kind of formed a high level strategy, but then we really wanted to unleash the creative potential of the entire product and engineering team. So we sponsored a hackathon where anyone could build anything AI related. And I mean, I review every single one. I mean, I watch every single video. I spend time taking notes on each and every one of those. Like, those things really are important to me. So, and I enjoy it. I mean, that's like, that's an evening with a glass of wine, sitting on my couch, spending hours watching a Zoom call. But it's, I think it's enjoyable. My wife knows I like doing it. You know, I just kind of like chill with my headphones on in the living room, watch them all. And yeah, it's a great way to keep close to the business.
That's very cool. I was just reflecting on when I was a chief customer officer at my last company that I was at. I used to interview everybody that came into my team, not the whole business, of course, but I did try to do the same thing. And the other hidden benefit of that is you get a chance to rally the person on the other end of the phone. So if they're questionable, if they're thinking about going to Pendo or somewhere else, you can get them fired up about Pendo because the other company CEOs probably aren't doing that, right?
Yeah. Thank you for that. Huge bonus. Like if I'm in this interview and I know they've already gotten a bunch of yeses because they got to me and I see this person's a rock star, what do you think's going to happen? No, I turn it on.
That's right.
And I basically like get that person to almost commit before I get off the phone with them. And then I go talk to the person. It's like, go hire this person now, which yeah. cuts through a lot of red tape and just like gets an offer out. And we get that person. So yeah, it was like absolutely a key to how we won in the early days of the business.
Yeah, I always used to ask people, am I buying or am I selling?
Yeah.
And if I'm selling, I'm turning it on pretty high. So talk to us, you know, we're an early stage company. We've just taken a little bit of funding. How do you think about, you know, going from seed to that A round? I know now you're in the private equity world, so you're well beyond that. You're also self-funding with your customer revenue. How do you think about when those inflection points are for actually taking that next round? Because they're usually dilutive to somebody, right? You have to believe that you've got the juice to get to the next level from where you are. How did you think about that in the early days?
Well, to me, raising money is about time because all money does is accelerate an outcome, right? Like if we felt like we had a longer window to go out there and like try to grab it and win it, we probably wouldn't have raised as much capital.
Yeah.
Done. But we saw at the time that like the winner of this market kind of needed to move. You need to move relatively quickly and money can increase speed of the company. So I think we started off from day one knowing we were going to be the kind of company that's going to raise capital, try to accelerate the creation of a category leader. And that's kind of like what our strategy was day one. You know, obviously, as I said earlier, one of my core jobs is to make sure we don't run out of money. So one of the key things in like timing of capital raises is making sure we never run out of money. That's obviously first principles thinking. But generally, I kind of looked at various milestones and you kind of think at a high level, like when I get this milestone, I'm going to press the gas a little more. When I get this next milestone, I'm going to press the gas a little more. And so obviously the first milestone after the seed round is like core product market fit. Once we felt like we had fit, we raised a pretty big Series A and that helps you press the gas to go hire a go-to-market team and try to find, you know, people call it go-to-market fit. But it's like, can we scale this thing? You know, there's other book says nail it and scale it. So like the next thing's about scaling. Technically, like the next few rounds are probably all about scaling at some level.
Yeah.
Different types of scaling. I do think that some of it's just, can you get initial traction and lands? I do think the renewal expansion business motion becomes a bigger part of the story later in a company's history, because I mean, honestly, at first, you're not really worried about renewals. They're kind of sort of just happening. Eventually become really important, if not the most important part of your business, I think, in many, many respects. For us, we always knew that we were going to start sort of mid-market-ish and eventually move up market to the enterprise. So then the later rounds of funding were like, hey, we need to build an enterprise sales team. We're going to raise capital to go build an enterprise sales team. No, by the way, they're super expensive because they have long ramp times.
Yeah.
So like, this is what we need to think to do that, start showing the traction. Once we start getting traction there, it's like, oh, we need to build an international sales team. And you know, part of this in the SaaS world is driven by this whole trough. There's always this trough where you hire a bunch of people, you're paying them before they're fully productive, and eventually start getting productive, and then you see this accelerant curve after. So you're raising money to basically accommodate the trough and come out faster at the other side. So that's kind of how we always thought about it. The other thing, that another like little hack that I used throughout the company's history, is we would raise money when I knew I could double the previous round valuation. And for years, that was an easy metric. I think certainly people going from 2021 to 2023 had that breakage because of the drop in the market valuation, mostly because 21 was overvalued. But if you look pre-21, that's a pretty good way to look at like general bumps throughout that, I think, throughout it. And I just said, like, look, doubling, as I told my new investors every time they come, I'm like, look, the way I think about my responsibility as CEO is I'll try to find a way to double your money. I feel like that's my job as the person that you're investing in. Like, I'm going to try to work hard. So doubling your money could happen two ways. With the same multiple, I had to double my revenue, which in the early days, we were doubling pretty darn fast. So it didn't really matter. Yeah. Pretty easy. Now, I mean, our size and scale of doubling is very, very hard. So then maybe it's a multi-year return. But and look, with multiple compression, it could take longer. But like, that's generally how I think about it.
Can we drill into the customer renewals inflection point that you mentioned? Because that's where we are right now, where and pricing has been a big theme for us the last couple of months too, because we kind of price to optimize for fast closes the first couple of years. And now we've had customers that have been with us multiple years. They've grown, we've grown, and we're kind of having to claw back to the start of the discussion of, you know, renewing these customers and their subscriptions. What were those early days like? Do you remember like how you approached it? We'd love to just hear about that experience, because that's where we are right now.
Yeah, so we had a really big turning point during that, like after this post Series A, when we started hiring a bunch of reps and they started closing a bunch of deals. And just for context, at the time, like our lowest entry level price point for Pendo at the time was $99 a month. Now, if anyone knows anything about Pendo, knows that that sounds really, really inexpensive. Well, it was back then for a short period of time. Now, here's the funny thing. It had existed from the time we started doing the go-to-market, but I was the primary seller. And like, I would hand-pick which customers I wanted to close, and they were never the $99 a month ones. So it was never really an issue, this $99 price point. Then you hire five new sales reps who are, you know, they're given a price book of $99 a month, and they say, go run at it. And all of a sudden, like, we started closing a ton of these deals. And my CTO's like, what's going on? Nothing's going on. We have a $99 price point. We have people, we told them to sell. They're selling. He's like, well, this seems like a problem. Like, unless we kill the SKU, it's going to get sold. So what do? One day I came into the office and I was like, minimum price point to work with Pendo is $1,000 a month. Well, $1,000 a month is 10x more, as you guys know. And that's a big difference.
Yeah.
And my head of sales is like, whoa, blah, blah, blah. I was like, you know what? This isn't really a debate. We're just going to make this one. And you know what? After that, like, everything took off. Now, if you had signed up for $99 a month and I came to it renewal and I said immediately it's 10x more, it's a hard conversation. Yeah, 2x, I mean, it's not the easiest conversation, but it's easier than 10x. So I think for those early customers, we had a migration path. You know, we'd quote the normal list price and we'd have a grandfathered in discount that would be, you know, frankly, that would shrink year over year until they finally got to that natural steady state price point. Over the years, we've increased pricing many times or adjusted. I mean, look, we're also shipping features every single month, folks. I'm sure you are too. It's not like our products aren't getting better. Let's step back. I mean, I still think Pendo, and I really believe this, and I am not just saying this, that we are inexpensive relative to the value that we deliver. Like, I know it. I talk to customers and some of the use cases and like ROI and it's like 5-10x, you know, more valuable than what we're charging. So like, now if you believe that about your own software, like, I think you've got pricing power, you know, and you hear it from customers. So I think the challenge is to be confident.
Yeah.
Be confident. You know, look, we're all in business situations. I've never met a single customer, and we as customers don't have, none of us go into a store and say, we want to pay more for this item, right? No one does. Like, that would be considered nonsense to walk into the grocery store. Well, I really love this milk. I'm going to pay a dollar more than everyone else. So when you ask someone what they're willing to pay, they're always going to say something less, or they're always going to say something modest. They always want a deal. I think the key is to be confident. Be confident. Anchor the conversation back to value. And one of the other interesting tidbits that we learned early on is that venture capitalists, when doing their diligence, would speak with a lot of customers. And what they kept telling us is that we had abilities to raise prices.
Mm.
Because as an independent third party doing research, customers are more likely to tell them that they're willing to pay more.
Right.
They're not going to tell you ever that they're willing to pay more. they're going to tell you no way in heck, or my procurement leader does this, you know, blah, blah, you know. So like, just be confident. And like, I think it generally works out.
I had a teacher in high school. She taught us how to type on typewriters. Todd, I think Baird, you remember that too, probably. And she used to say, you can go out in the bathroom, or you can go out to the hall and go to the bathroom if you want, but you walk like you know where you're going and you'll never get stopped. That's what she used to say. She taught us that. So be confident. And if you walk like you're confident and you walk into those conversations and say, yeah, this is what our pricing is. You know, here's the value we're delivering. But there is something to being anchored to that lower price point. You're absolutely right, where you can't just say, hey, look, like, you know the value of this thing. We're going to 10x your price. You can't go there. That's harder to do. But for new customers, especially in the early days when you're closing a lot of them, it's sort of fair game and it works.
Here's the other thing to think about as well. And then, by the way, I've owned pricing for companies before Penda. So I think pricing, especially in a SaaS business, is probably one of the most interesting, most important levers to really think about. And, you know, this concept of elasticity. Sometimes elasticity curve in such a way where you can increase price and it won't affect demand at all. And that was what happened in our case. Like, we increased price 10x and it didn't change demand. Obviously, very, very positive thing.
Yeah.
It actually had another positive impact. It sifted out the people who were serious for the person that were not serious. Because if you're just slapping something on your credit card for $999 a month and you don't care about it, those folks didn't install. Worse, they didn't respond to our calls when we called them to tell them they weren't installed. So when they were willing to commit $1,000, and they're putting their name on it and they're getting budget approval for it, they're going to call you back when something, because like, their now neck is on the line for this purchase they brought in for, you know, 12 grand a year. So, you know, and look, fighting with that, like, 12 grand may not be material for whatever market whoever's listening to this is in, that may be very small. Maybe it's 100 grand. I don't know what it is. But I think, make sure you charge enough where your customer thinks it matters, where they get back to you. Like, 90% of our implementation issues have nothing to do with Pendo's product.
That's right.
They have everything to do with the customer not responding to you, or not caring, or priority shifting. If they spend it like $1 million, there was no priority shifting.
You are the priority.
That would be, yeah. So like, so think about that when you enter into a business relationship with someone. Like, if this is to them a $99 a month problem, how much do they care? And do we want this as a customer? Do we want the customer that's willing to spend a lot more? You know, and look, and I'll step back for a second. I love all of our customers. I love the 10K ones. I love the $1 million ones. We're actually fortunate to have both. I think we're actually fortunate that, I don't know if we share this stat publicly too much, but like, just over 15% of our 100K customers are companies under 250 employees. That's crazy. You know, so we are the largest spend for some of these companies. So we take their feedback very, very seriously. We make sure that they're getting like incredible value out of our products. Because they're a small company. In that case, we probably have CEO level access because it's that strategic important. But at least I know they care. They care. They're going to invest in it. We're investing in them. We take it very seriously. We're going to make them super successful because they bet on us and we're betting on them, right, as businesses. And like, that's the kind of partnerships I want to have. Ones where we're kind of betting on each other. Like, let's go win together.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I found pricing to be probably the hardest thing as a founder to work on. And it's a constant revisit as well, I'm starting to find. And I'm just curious, like, do you have a framework for working through pricing, or like, how have you, you know, somebody that's just getting started, how would you kind of approach them to think about pricing?
Yeah, look, I think about the concept of, how do you measure the value derived from your product and what levers increase it or decrease it? And, you know, sort of how natural are those levers and what incentives to provide versus not. So I'll give you a couple examples of ours. So like, we charge our monthly active users. Yeah, actually, I'll just walk through how I came up with our pricing, because it's different than other folks. And it walks you through a lot of my thinking around how to do it. And while we've tested this and like adjusted it, the core principles remain the same. So we do monthly active users. Monthly active users is how many end users our customers have. So first out of the gate is, I haven't met many companies in the world that don't want more users of their software. And monthly implies a release coming in month. So even if you had someone coming in every other month, if somehow by using Pendo, I could get that person to come back just now every month, that's value. That's a stickier user. That's good for our customers. hopefully then good for us as well. The other thing when I think about this is like a lot of our competitors actually still priced on event volume. Event volume is how much data is coming from those end users. Now, no customer I met actually could ever guess their event volume. It was an impossible metric for them to tell us. So when you're coming into a business relationship and they just have literally no idea how much it's going to cost, kind of a tough way to start a business relationship, right? It was very unpredictable. Now, do we encounter situations where sometimes companies with certain number of users send us way more events, and some send us way fewer? Yes. That means our gross margin on certain customers varies. Overall, it averages all out.
Right.
And we picked a metric that everyone knew. And I think that's been like a good way to think about it. Another one of our competitors charged on sessions. Again, no one had any idea nor control, by the way, over the sessions. Very, very hard measure. So one, it's a measure that clearly as value went up, helped the customer. Henceforth, I can go back and ask for more. And two, was kind of easy to measure. Yeah. So easiness is part of it. Now, the other thing that's interesting, early on, we decided not to charge on seats. Therefore, product teams and CS teams and sales teams could all use Log Independent. We wouldn't charge you a dollar more.
Mm, yeah.
Now, going back to my early concepts, does value increase when more users use it? 100%. 100%. Like we're not denying that that's the case. The challenge is if I started charging money for that, they could potentially have a risk of not getting as viral and sticky as I wanted. So when I'm thinking about retention and expansion, I want more people to use it. And what I didn't want in the early days of the company is people sharing logins. So I've seen that happen throughout my career. And if you charge too much on seats, you can get sharing of logins. And actually similar, that goes back to the event thing, is I've watched people say, well, I won't capture this one event because it's super important. So if I charge on events, I can have people like cherry picking events, and then like we could be missing some piece of critical business information. So that's where users, you're not going to cherry pick a user. You want all your users. Like these are the way I think about it. Like what incentives are you providing? What disincentives are you providing? Is it an easy value conversation? I was just talking about a customer this morning that has 4.5 million monthly active users, where they bought 4.5, but they're running hot at 8.8. Well, obviously 8.8 is a lot more than 4.5. So it's obviously driving a conversation, you know, about how do we reconcile this? And like, is this good for your business? So like, yes, it's good for our business. Okay, good. Well, now that we've both agreed upon that, let's figure out, you know, how we work through it. So that's kind of how we think about pricing. Everything's on a MAL curve now. Oh, and then the other thing is there has to be some level of discounting when you start getting to scale. So that's another thing to think about building into
pricing. Right.
So we have essentially built-in discount curves for monthly active users because the incremental cost of a monthly active user at 1 million should be obviously less than at 1,000. So like that's obviously baked in as well, because if what people typically do is they hear about 1,000 monthly active users and they think 1 million in their head, they draw a linear curve and they're like, oh my gosh, you're being way too expensive. And we're like, calm down. That's not the way it works.
Got to level off somewhere.
So we kind of build that in as well. But look, we've tested with third-party firms pricing a bunch. We've used like conjoint analysis, a bunch of things. That like when we do new products, sometimes we do market level testing. For example, we just launched new session replay product as an add-on product. And you know, there we did a lot of testing with customers. And actually there was like one of the interesting tests we were doing. We're trying to like measure like what's the percentage uplift based on other modules in Pendo that we think, or what's the relative value that customers graded at. So we realized that people valued it close to our analytics product, but a little bit less. So we kind of priced it within that range. We kind of come up with a MAL pricing that was like sort of like a little less than one of our products, more than some of the others. And that's kind of how it drove. And honestly, it's yielding to be the right price. So at least from what I'm seeing and the data. And look, if you get something wrong, you can discount. That's what I tell my teams all the time. I always bias a little high. You can always discount. You can't increase price. Like it's harder. Like if you're an accountant, you're like, oh my gosh, we are giving this away. List price. I mean, not much you can do.
Yeah.
So, but if you start high, you can always come down a bit, right? So you have that flexibility to do so. So that's kind of like, hopefully that was helpful.
Yeah. Two things stick out to me about that. One is you see a lot, and actually some of our competitors do this. You can tell that they are trying to, the reason they align with a metric that people may not fully understand is because they're trying to maximize the alignment between value and cost, right? They're trying to extract the most value for the most dollars for the most value that they provide and keep those two things very tightly. But you said something really important there, which is there are puts and takes to it ultimately. And it sort of comes out in the wash when you have enough customers.
Yeah, I think it, by the way, it's very dangerous to price solely on cost. You're pricing on value, especially when you're an early stage company. Like, and I think my CTO and I are very, very aligned on this early days is when you're a young company, a lot of your infrastructure is not focused on cost. Your infrastructure was built to focus on speed, get something out fast.
Yeah.
Eventually you get to a point, I think for us, it happened like 4 or 5 years ago, we started having an increased focus on cost. We knew that, like, look, to be a public company, we had to have kind of high 70s gross margin. We were probably running in the 60s at the time. And our story to investors was always the same. Like, when we will care about gross margin, we will fix this. So we always knew we would.
Yeah.
And that really helped improve some of these customers over time. Because we do look at costs on a per customer basis. And we know that there are some that we are losing money. I think there could be even some now, even at our size and scale. I don't know if we quite lose money, but we're certainly break even-ish. But over time, our infrastructure costs continue to go down and down and down. So they become more and more profitable over time.
It's sort of riding like the cloud version of Moore's Law to some degree too, right?
Yeah. And a lot of it is just like we did something like stupid in the early days. Like right now, we still retain pretty much all data. Like who the hell's going back 7 years to look at some like chart? Like 7 years. I think for some customers, we have like almost 10 years of data. You know, that we're paying to keep, probably don't need to. And we still have high 70s gross margin. So that gives you a sense for like how we think about this. But our CTO was great sometimes. He would say like, we're going to lose money on it, but we shouldn't change our pricing because of it. Our pricing needs to align with value always. We need to fix the infrastructure to get the cost down.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's the answer. Fix the infrastructure.
Right. That's a project at some point in time, but not necessarily the one you need to focus on today, depending on what you're structure and strategy is, right?
Yeah. This morning, I was talking that $40 million monthly active user customer, that's going to be a tight one from a margin perspective. But I can't show the logo. It's a nice, you know, it's an interesting logo and it's a great use case. And we want to partner with them on this. So we're going to do the deal.
Well, then you find other value points for you, right? I mean, if that logo is attractive enough and you can put that on your website and promote them as a customer, then you get other benefit out of that.
Yeah.
So maybe that's part of the offset, right?
Exactly.
All right. Got one more line of questioning. This is great, by the way. Thank you for taking the time to do this. We just hopped right in and this is exactly the way we wanted to do it. So
perfect.
Appreciate you rolling with us. How do you think about product-led versus sales-led growth? I know you all have, you see a lot of product-led companies. I know you see a lot of sales-led. I think you all have dabbled in both from what I understand. Where's your current thinking on the balance there?
So first off, my definition of product-led maybe is a little different than everyone else. I have a more, I would say, expansive view of product-led. I think being product-led is the spectrum. And obviously one end of the spectrum is like completely no humans involved, self-service, purchase credit card, blah, blah, blah. And that's what a lot of people only think of as product-led, but I think of it as just a spectrum of it. And the reason I start there is that a lot of people look at us and like they would say we're mostly sales-led. Because we started with a sales team and you could not transact online until actually pretty recently, until about a year or two ago. And the reason is that we just weren't having success people doing it themselves. It simply wasn't working. When I would get on the phone and I would explain things, it was working. So I'm not crazy. If something's not working, I'm not going to keep doing it just because I have some dogmatic view towards PLG. Like I'm going to like try to fix it. If somehow sales thing's working, which it was, I'm going to lean into that. So I think like most people would have described this as sales-led. But the reason I started with this fact that there's a spectrum comes down to very often what those early calls would be is a description, of course, of what we're doing, some like very lightweight elicitation of pain, things like that. It was often just getting people to try our product because we knew that we won 2/3 of every trial. So if you're winning 2/3 of every trial, like get people using the product early in the trial. And that is basically a product-led technique. Like it is like, once we got them in the product, we knew we could help close them. And then our sales folks were definitely experts in the product. So they would help people along with it. Very, very smart. We've always had a smart, savvy sales team from the very, very beginning, but that worked. Now, fast forward today, we have a probably more sophisticated go-to-market. We still have salespeople. We still do a lot of trials. We now have a free version, which is pretty big. We have 5,000-6,000 free signups a quarter,
wow,
which for a B2B, you know, is pretty good. Now, one of the biggest drop-offs in that funnel is the install. And it was pretty funny because I was talking to a number of companies and other founders in our market. And like the install is one of the reasons it's challenging to be fully PLG in our market. It's challenging. It requires a developer to like drop a piece of code in a production system.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like signing up for Jira and dropping a few tickets in, or signing up for Airtable and starting to throw your random data into a like online spreadsheet. It's not that. It is call a developer and get them to update code and send data to a foreign system.
Right.
So you got to get like your DPA involved, and you like if you care at all about security or privacy, like where the hell is this data going? And like, should I trust it? It's very different signing up for an online spreadsheet. I think inherently we're just going to be our market and our solution is going to be less PLG than an Airtable or a Notion. It has to be. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
I'm okay with that. Now, we do, again, have a good free version and we have a bunch of other things, but I think we found a good motion for us. And now here's the other thing that I think is not spoken about as much. So maybe the sales is the landers, the new logo, but now we're experimenting more with product-led expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I've already gotten through a DPA. That's someone's right. Already installed our snippet. Presenting a new technology right within the product and getting them to do expansion revenue. Oh, well, that's pretty different. It's actually probably a little easier. So we're experimenting a lot with new module sales. Is that we're going to give people teasers of the product via expansion revenue. So I think that if you're looking at NRR, that's actually maybe more interesting from a product-led world for us, at least, than just like landing new customers. So I think our full story on PLG isn't done. Like we're still writing it, and it's an interesting one. And like many stories here, it's like sort of nuanced. But if I'd been dogmatic, I mean, I would not be sitting here talking.
That word was in my mind the whole time you were talking. It's like you have to avoid dogma in these things. You have to listen to your customers. You have to look at your market, the way your product interacts with it, and that's going to give you the answer.
We made that mistake early on. We come from PLG. Our previous companies were PLG focused. And when we started Churnkey, we ran the same PLG motion for this B2B software. And I bet we lost almost a year because we just didn't match up with what our customers needed. We have an install component as well, which speaks. We experienced the exact same thing. Exactly. And we're currently experiencing it and updating. So it's just, that's really, really helpful advice.
Yeah. Like, do what works. And, yeah, I see this a lot of people that come from the B2C world because they immediately try to replicate the same things. And now, look, it means you have to build a sales team, which is kind of challenging, and like it creates different challenges. But I like our model and it's worked. And like I said, I do think there's product led aspects of even the sales led motion. You know, you see it, and we're looking at more ways we can do it. I mean, like helping our CS team with like putting value calculators in the product. That's something we're exploring right now. There's a lot of things you can do.
Yeah.
Maybe different than the initial land, which requires more stakeholders to get involved.
Yeah. Awesome. Love the perspective, man. Appreciate you taking the time to do this. And we'd love to do it again sometime.
Yeah. I love this kind of stuff. And honestly, like, I have to remind myself of some of these early stories because some of them, there's a lot of funny ones.
Well, maybe there's a fourth job to being the founder CEO at your level. And it's the historian, right? You get to remind people how you sort of made the transition from a 6-person startup to, a multi-billion-dollar company, which is cool.
Well, this is one of the jokes I have with my product team. Because the question is, as CEO, why am I involved in product as much? So yes, one, it's my strength, my background. But I am the longest tenured product person at the company. Like, I remember the decision when we built this versus not. So like, and once a new product manager gets over the fact that I'm the CEO and they realize if they talk to me about a product thing, I'll give them probably more historical context of why whatever they're working on works the way it does. They embrace me and they talk to me and they run ideas by me. And I think I had a ton more value in that than people probably talk about. Like, and probably every founder does, because at some point you're going to turn over enough people, like, and hopefully have a few left. Like, we have a couple designers that are very tenured. But yeah, I'm the most tenured product person. So it's fun. Like
it's cool.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, look, great hanging with you guys, and have a good weekend.
Awesome. Thanks, Todd.
Appreciate it, man. All right, have a great weekend.
Yeah.
Take care.